You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Brand Enabled podcast. I'm here today with Norman Guadagno, who's the CMO of Mimecast. Welcome, Norman. It's great to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me, and I look forward to chatting.
And where are you joining us from today?
I am in my home in the quiet corner of Connecticut, northeastern Connecticut, literally 4 miles from the Massachusetts border. Our office is just outside Boston.
Let's get straight into it because we've got a lot to talk about today. So you've got a really interesting background. You kind of cut your teeth at Oracle and Microsoft. And today you're CMO of Mimecast. And today we're going to be talking a lot about the topic of brand transformation because you've done that at three different companies. And we're going to talk about the similarities and differences and the playbook that you've developed as part of that. But why don't you start by talking a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today and the different step changes in your career.
Yeah, for sure. And it's always interesting when I get an opportunity to reflect on the background that got me here. And sometimes I have referred to myself as an accidental marketer. I sort of stumbled into it somewhere along the way, but maybe I was always destined to be a marketer. I began early on in the technology space, really because I just love technology. And I had an opportunity when I was in grad school to start working on software and you know, human computer interaction. And I just really love the power of technology and what it can do for people. And so that sort of drew me into the business. I began early on working on product management and product marketing. And it turns out that if you're not a software developer in the software business, you sort of end up in marketing or sales or someplace else. And as I like to say, if you have no real skills, you end up becoming a marketer, which is a joke because I believe that is a real skill. But I ended up doing that. And I found that I not only loved the software business, but I loved the marketing aspects. That is the, how do we convince people that they want this thing? Right? Because even when it seems tremendously appealing, there's six other companies that have something also tremendously appealing. So it's actually a real challenge. So I worked my way up through the ranks at some startups. I spent time at Oracle and at Microsoft and continued to sort of refine my role and what I'm good at, as in that thinking about how to create a connection and resonance between the business and our prospective customers. And over time, I found that I was also good at thinking somewhat holistically and strategically how do pieces come together, which I think is a natural element to move into more senior leadership roles, is to start to look at the bigger picture, if you will. So I worked my way up the ranks. And when I got the opportunity to jump to the first sort of lead a marketing team role, I took it. I did okay. Right? It was also really hard. And in fact, after the first couple of times I was leading a marketing team, I stepped back and said, wow, that's really hard. And then I went to work at my first agency because I'd employed agencies for so long. I was really curious as to what they did. So it turns out over time, I've had the opportunity to work at a few agencies and to work as a client-side marketer, which is somewhat rare when you're in that CMO seat to have done both. I came back to the marketing side and I said, okay, here's a set of things I'm really good at, and I could apply that to brand transformation, marketing transformation. How do you weave together brands and performance marketing, as I suspect we'll talk about. So it's been a long, strange journey, but at the core of it, it comes back to, I love convincing people that they should be interested in and buy the thing that I'm representing. And if I can do it for something that I actually believe in, as I do now in cybersecurity, all the better.
There's a couple of things I want to dig into what you just said, but just talk a little bit more about what Mimecast actually does.
Yeah, for sure. And straightforward, we're a cybersecurity provider. We provide solutions for email, collaboration, security, as well as tools in security awareness training and human risk management. So basically, for our 40,000 some odd customers around the globe, we're scanning their emails or scanning their Slack or Teams and making sure that the bad stuff doesn't get in.
A couple of things I want to dig into in what you talked about. You talked about the first marketing leadership position you had. It was really hard. Talk more about what made it hard.
You know how they tell you when you move out of being an individual contributor to a leader, you have to give up like being the expert and you have to sort of become the team leader. It's easier said than done. And when you do it, particularly if you're doing it at a relatively early stage in your career, and I started leading a marketing team relatively early in my career, I didn't know what I didn't know. And as a result, I was running more by what I was good at rather than what was the right thing to do. And I see that in a lot of leaders who move into positions where they revert back to their natural strengths and their natural comfort zone versus thinking about, okay, there's a bunch of things I don't know here. What am I going to do? And it usually takes being knocked upside the head two or three times before you get to the place where you're like, oh, wait, maybe I need to learn, look, listen, ask, get some input, take a broader perspective, take a breath, pause. So that first time at bat, it was a swing and a miss, right? It was an opportunity to say, oh, I actually wasn't thinking really strategically and I wasn't thinking holistically as a marketer. But could I learn from that, which hopefully I did.
Oftentimes when we have this type of conversation, what I hear often is notion of first you have to consciously decide what you're going to stop doing, even before you can decide what you need to start.
That notion of we develop a set of habits and patterns and things that we know we can go do, right? And it's like pull back from that. And I think that's an important point. I find, you know, humorously, even today, like I still find myself wanting to like go do copywriting because I'm fairly good at it and I enjoy it. And it's like, wait, let me just sort of futz with this copy. And I have to pull myself back most of the time from doing that. But more, you know, strategically, it's ultimately about the fact that the very definition of a team is that there are multiple people there. And the leader can't do everything. In fact, the leader has to learn to step back more and more, the bigger the team. Right? And I find, honestly, in most situations now, at this point in my career, it's about how little I say, and maybe it's about how little I end up doing, right? Because I have to give my team the opportunity to really do what they're good at. And I provide gentle nudges along the way and input across that, because I know that my gentle nudge on an organization of 100 people actually has some significant impact, and I have to be comfortable and confident in that.
You talked about the role of marketing, about trying to convince customers, prospects to choose ours versus others that are very similar. Is that something that you use internally as almost a North Star for everyone in the team that's codified? Or is it just something that we're just talking about informally?
It's a good question. And I think I internally believe that fundamentally, because I know that at the end of the day, we're going to have to convince somebody of something. And I actually don't know that I make it something that the team says, oh, yeah, that's our North Star, because I try to be a little bit broader in how we do that. But I think personally, I've always believed that marketing is a function that does something no one else can do, right? Which is convince you to pay attention, right? To create a sense of resonance in the moment. And lots of things fight for our attention, more so now than ever. And our job in marketing is to capture your attention for just a moment. And then if I capture for that moment, I can hand you to a qualified seller, or I can do something else with you. Like that's process. But the moment of capturing someone's attention is to me personally very powerful. Now, the marketing team as a whole, we have a lot of things we do. We do that. We move them through the pipeline and we take them through their, all the stages. We produce content. Like, we do tons and tons of stuff. But all of which is to have that moment where you think, oh, Mimecast. Like, yeah, wait. I want to think about them for a moment. And that creates new opportunities.
When you talked about how you got your first marketing leadership position, you mentioned that it was this ability to be able to make connections. Talk a bit more about what you mean by that, because I think there's a lot of people who might be in a mid-career or more senior role that's thinking about, okay, how do I get from where I am to that marketing leadership standpoint?
This is a perfect parallel sort of discussion to, you know, when I think about my career. At some point, I realized I was good at pattern recognition. And I have found, and having had the good fortune to work for a lot of great leaders, that the best of them are almost always really good at pattern recognition. And I have tried to model myself on that, understanding that as you move up and you've seen things enough times, you start to widen the aperture and you get that ability to recognize patterns. Even as you move across industries or you move across audiences, you see consistent patterns happen again and again. And I have found as a leader, and for when I look for leaders, like, there can be somebody who's amazing at a particular function, but they can't see how you could like do something else over here that might take all the patterns that they've learned and just replicate it with a different set of content. The people who move up and become good at that not only see this, but they also start to see patterns and things outside their own domain. It's like, oh, wait, this is what this function does repeatedly. I now recognize that pattern and I can leverage that for part of a bigger ecosystem. So that self-realization of pattern recognition has helped me realize that that's one of the criteria that really does elevate people as they start to move into bigger, more strategic leadership roles. And that can be leading a big team, that can be leading a small team, but the bigger you get, the more you start to see pattern recognition. And then like abstract that to the highest level of, you know, the titans of industry that any one of us may admire. If you actually dig into what any of them has had as a core principle of how they've been successful, it is often pattern recognition. Sometimes it's anti-pattern recognition, right? And like, just look at Steve Jobs, right? See what the pattern is and go the other way. That in and of itself is indicative of that ability to recognize those broader patterns across markets, industries, people, audiences, society.
How do you identify those traits within members of your team? So, all right, these 10 people are really good at pattern recognition. These 10 people aren't.
Yeah, it's not easy. But let's just be clear. I wish I had some magic metric for recognizing those patterns, but I really don't. What I do see is that I try to spend a lot of time looking and listening to how people behave when confronted with the unexpected, because it's the unexpected that sort of shows, can they say, oh, wait, I've never seen that before. What am I going to do? And it's either I'm going to resort to, I've never seen that before, and I'm just going to go do the thing that I've always done. Or is it like, whoa, that's sort of like this other thing. Maybe if I just make these adjustments, I can address that, right? And that to me is the, if there's any one thing I look for, is that how they deal with those unexpected and how they process it and how they look at it. And those are the signals that I look for that help me say, yeah, this is somebody who really gets it.
That's a really interesting insight, how people behave when confronted with the unexpected. I think that's also, if I'm listening to this, that's something that I can self-reflect on as well. I think about the situations that I encounter, anyone listening to this, when they encounter, how do you deal with those? Because it feels like there's a parallel, or that there's a natural correlation between this notion of being able to connect the dots and looking at pattern recognition, also with being a divergent thinker. Personality tests, and I'm dumbing it down, but you know, the Myers-Briggs, all of those, they you can take those and actually actually see, okay, how much, you know, are you a divergent thinker?
Right. And there was a great question too, because I know I've sort of codified this in my own mind over time, and I've thought a lot about this, but I do think that anyone at any stage of their career has to be able to self-reflect and say, okay, I'm being asked to do something I've never been asked to do before, or something happened that I've never seen before. What is my response? And asking yourself that question and being able to say, oh, my response is I'm going to panic, or my response is I'm going to step back and try to deconstruct and decompose to figure out a way forward, or I'm going to phone a friend, or whatever it may be, like, helps you realize that the further along you get, and this is the interesting sort of paradox, right? The further along you get in your career, the more you're going to see the same patterns over and over again, and the more you're going to frankly encounter the unexpected. And so being able to ride those two somewhat paradoxical waves is critical to ultimately being really, I think, successful.
One last thing that you said in your intro that I wanted to touch on was this idea of having been client side or agency side. How did going agency side then influence you, both in terms of your role and how you work with agencies, especially when you went back, but maybe also talk about how your client side experience influenced then how you work when you're an agency, and maybe how that even might have compared with some of your peers.
It's something I actually have reflected quite a bit on, because I feel very fortunate that I've been able to be on both client and agency side multiple times. And for anyone who's watching and listening to this today, if you've been either on client or agency, you know the experience of being a client. You hire a bunch of agencies to do a bunch of work and you make a bunch of assumptions. Being an agency person, you get hired by a bunch of clients to do a bunch of work and you make a bunch of assumptions about that. Before I ever joined an agency the first time, I made a bunch of assumptions about how agencies operate. Turns out many of them are wrong.
Like what?
I think first off, like, we assume that the operating model of the agency is aligned with the operating model of the business. Turns out it's not, right? The operating model of an agency is very much driven. Of course, they're looking for client success, but they're also looking at an optimization model of costs and investment and timing and all of those things. The client is looking for, I need unparalleled success as quickly as possible on whatever schedule within the budget that I have. Those things are the natural sort of structure, but they can be in conflict, but we often don't remember that conflict. The second thing that's actually critical, even more critical in my opinion, is the availability of information to the agency and to the client is drastically different, in that clients assume that they've transmitted all the necessary information to agencies. That's almost always never the case. Agencies assume that clients have told them everything they need to know. Almost never the case. And a good portion of the conflict or disappointment that may result in client-agency relationships comes from a mismatch of information and information that they think each other have. And you see this, and I've seen this time and again, where someone inside a client will say, oh, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, we didn't have to share that with the agency. And I'll look at it and I'm like, I think that's actually the most important thing we should tell them. And it often is, but it's like, well, but that wasn't in the brief, as if the brief magically communicates all the stuff below the surface to an agency. And the people who work in agencies have different motivations. They're working on a bunch of clients. the person who's the client, that's their life. Like, we must get X done, and it is my all-consuming 24/7 thing. Now, it's nice if your agency is also only focused on that, but it's very rare. They're thinking about, like, I got a lot of things to do, and it's when this project's done, I'll probably move off to another project. The person on the client side is thinking, when this project's done, and hopefully successfully, I get promoted, or I get a bonus, or, like, there's just a divergence there, and we could spend forever talking about this topic. But to me, it was eye-opening going to an agency for the first time and seeing how it truly functioned, and then reflecting on how I might have behaved previously as a client and what I would do differently.
So now that you are a client, what do you do differently now when you work with agencies?
I make sure that they are as engaged with the information that's available as possible. I want to bring them in to the team. I want to break down every barrier I can so that they get full transparency and that they're not treated as just the agency, that they're treated as truly an engaged partner and that they know as much as anyone on the internal team. I also want to make sure that they are super clear on what my deadlines are, what my priorities are, what my budget is, what resources I have, what resources I don't. I don't pretend anything. I lay it all out as transparently as possible.
And what's the flip side of that then in terms of what makes an agency a good partner? Because it's interesting, there are some similarities sometimes when I think about the notion of being a software company and being an agency, where a software company, you've got six people that do exactly the same thing. And you get something very similar with agencies, right? You're going to see the same case studies, the same process, the same things. And oftentimes it's not just the decision in how you choose within a pitch process, but then, you know, 2 years down the line when you reflect on those relationships.
Yeah. You know, I think that the best agencies are those that from my perspective and that I work with, are those that are looking for long-term relationships, are looking to produce the best possible work, of course, but even sometimes in short-term relationships, who get what the business is doing and who realize that, and let's just zoom in on a specific example around creative agencies. There are many different types of agencies, but let's just talk about creative. The best creative shops realize that it's not about the best creative. It's about the best creative for the client. It's about the creative that's going to work in the client's world, with the client's mindset, with the client's ethos, with the client's appreciation of X, Y, or Z. And that seems super simple and obvious, but frankly, it's not. In practice, it's often that sometimes agencies will get consumed with producing what they think is the best creative, not the best creative for the particular client in that particular situation.
How can you diagnose those pieces?
Yeah, and part of it is, as a client, you have to really make clear not just who is making the decisions and who's influencing them, but what they actually are looking for, what they care about, what they think about and want. And as a CMO, I often have to be very sensitive to the CEO or the board. And, you know, I'll use an example from, frankly, it's happened multiple times in my career, as a CMO presenting to a board of directors. And as I sometimes do, although I try to avoid having to present creative or things of that nature, and members of the board will sit at their laptop and they will look at their favorite competitor or their favorite other company that they love. And they won't be looking at the thing you're showing. They'll be comparing you to the thing they know on their screen. And if you don't know that, and you didn't prepare for that, you're gonna end up in a bad place. That's how the best creatives can say, oh yeah, I know that all the board's gonna be sitting there looking at XYZ site. We need to be able to have a story that makes it clear why this works in this context. I once had a board member, very smart individual. I knew that they were looking at one of the competitors, and they asked me the following question. Well, I've looked at competitor A, B, and C, and I'm now looking at this new thing. I don't understand why yours doesn't look like theirs. How do I know that you're the same type of stuff as them? They all have blue and silver and XYZ type of look, and you have green, and like, why doesn't it look more like these other competitors if that's who we're going after? And by the way, there's no good answer to that question.
But how did you answer it?
Truly, I said, the whole point is to not look like our competitors. The whole point is to create something that is both distinct and differentiated. And I have taken many people through the example of, I can go to a competitive set, remove the logos, and people who work for the companies can't tell which one's which. How is that going to create an opportunity to engage with a customer? But it's in all fairness, it's a hard question to answer because it's rooted in an understanding of the world that's different than the understanding we as marketers or creatives have. Yet that's the very point of the best agency-client relationships: acknowledge that that is going to happen and prepare for it, and acknowledge that, you know, the CEO might love the color green, and that's, we have to prepare for that as well.
Yeah, I love that as an example. We often do, we call it the sea of sameness exercise, where you take the positioning, the about, you know, a couple of sentences, the about us, four competitors in the same category, you remove the logo, say, okay, who is who? And right. You can do the same even with the expression, where you can suddenly remove the logo and say, can you tell?
Yeah, you truly can't. Yeah. And this is, it's a parallel path to this discussion, but it's the B2B software business in particular, but many categories, but you know, I know B2B software very well. It is overly fixated on differentiation at a feature function level and not on distinctiveness at a brand level. And that bites companies all the time.
So this goes back to the kind of part of the original theme of this conversation, which is you've come into three different B2B software companies in order to drive brand transformation and bring brand to the fore. I guess, were there similarities around them having that realization that that's what they needed, or did they bring you in for a more traditional thing and then you saw that, you diagnosed that and saw that as an opportunity?
Yeah, and it mostly tends to be being brought in to solve a performance problem. That is, the company is not performing the way it should. Occasionally you come in, and I have actually brought in to build or transform a brand. And you and I had spoken about this a little bit before this conversation around the brand versus performance marketing dilemma. And I, as most of us who are in my role or similar roles do, I get calls from recruiters all the time that says, oh, company X is looking for a new CMO and they really want someone who's a brand marketer, or company X is looking for a new CMO and they really want somebody who's a performance marketer because the CEO or the board has identified brand or performance as the problem that needs to be solved. And I always answer this same way. They're two sides of the same coin. There is no brand problem without a performance problem, no performance problem without a brand problem. What you have to be able to do is get under the covers and really look at what's the sequence of things that you need to fix. Many years ago, I joined a previous company, and when I got under the covers, it turned out that the performance stuff was actually okay. The brand stuff really wasn't, and we had to address the brand straight up. Sometimes I come into a company and it's the performance stuff seems like it's great, but it turns out that it's not. And you have to fix a bunch of that foundational work before you can even envision investing in brand. because an investment in brand on a broken foundation won't get you the return that you want. And so those two things are ultimately tightly coupled. Of course, if you asked me, am I better at brand or performance? I'll give you an answer, but it really depends on context. What I'm good at is seeing that those two things are tightly coupled and that you have to decide what's the sequence of which one you're going to address when, so that it naturally feeds on each other. When I came to Mimecast, we had a set of investments that I looked at that I felt were too heavily weighted towards performance. But you can't just rip the dollars and put them somewhere else. You have to build a path to redistributing dollars for your top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of funnel, and thinking about how you're going to end up in the place you want to be. And it gets back to pattern recognition. I want to be like this, but I can't do that overnight. What's a sequence of things I have to do to get to look like this ideally that balances brand and performance and gives me the outcomes I want?
And what was the insight or the indicator when you got into Mimecast that led you to that realization?
Simple. I just looked at a spreadsheet. and not to be too, you know, joking about it, but I just had to look at the spreadsheet and see that far more of our marketing dollars were being spent at the bottom of the funnel than they were at the top. And for a company like Mimecast, which is an amazing business that services customers all over the globe and has been in business for 21 years, you could just look at the brand awareness, and it's like it's lower than it should be for a company of our size and scope. You can look at the performance marketing, and it's like, wow, we do a lot of business. We transact a lot. Is there some balance that needs to be shifted there? And can I take an amazing brand like Mimecast and make it even more amazing as the landscape in which we compete changes? Because every company, it doesn't matter if it's my company, your company, every company, is not just in a competitive landscape, but it's in a dynamic competitive landscape. There are very few businesses nowadays that don't feel pressure from below, from above, from the sides, from macro factors, from changing audience desires. Like, every business is in a dynamic competitive landscape. And you have to think carefully about what worked even 2 years ago won't necessarily work today in that landscape.
So when you came into Mimecast and so much of it was focused on performance marketing, how did you start? Did you realize that you also had to start addressing some of the core foundations of the brand around what's our core positioning, purpose, even looking at then the creative expression, the verbal identity, all those pieces as well?
And fortunately, the team had already done a lot of good work sort of setting up an understanding of the landscape, of investing in who we are, what we do. And, you know, our business in particular, if you know anything about the cybersecurity space, it's a very crowded space. There are thousands of companies in cybersecurity. It's really interesting as a marketer, right, to think about just the vast number of them. And they all do something slightly different, yet overlaps, and we all interconnect with each other. And
it's not just the software companies. You've got the additional aspect. You've got the McKinsey's and the Deloitte. You've got the consultancies. Yes. If you look at it through the audience who you're trying to reach, and that share of attention or share of voice, it's there's a direct competitor, but I imagine there's different concentric circles around
that. It's so well put, right? If you go to a CISO, a chief information security officer at a company, and you say, name 10 cybersecurity companies. Name 25. Name 50. Right? Some of them might be able to do that, but I guarantee you, most of them have 50 or more, if they're an enterprise, they have 50 or more companies already in place inside their business. And it's not a criticism of the CISO, it's overwhelming, like all the participants that may get involved. So for a company to stand out, you have to actually really have a clear, strong value proposition that is distinct and that is based in the value you create. Like we're in the business of what every other cybersecurity business is stopping the bad things from happening. That's ultimately what it's about, because the adversaries, they're out there coming up with new ways to attack and to get into companies every day. Every cybersecurity company is fighting those adversaries, whether they be individuals, groups, state sponsored, it doesn't matter. There's a ton of adversaries, and it's easier than ever for adversaries to attack a company. The advent of new technologies, AI, all of these things give them the ability to attack at scale. And the humans, who are the weakest link, are all overwhelmed because everything is competing for their attention. So the easiest thing for any one of us to do is to accidentally click a link in an email without thinking about it and opening the door to ransomware or some other type of attack. So the problem is everywhere. Now, how in that landscape can we help companies at Mimecast understand, oh, Mimecast does this? We do it in connection with key partners like a CrowdStrike or a Palo Alto Networks or any of the other big players. We are tightly integrated with them. But we do something very specific. We focus on the fact that people are at risk, whether through their own behavior or because of the position they're in. We can talk about that. And people spend most of their time in communication and collaboration tools. That is, we work in email and Teams and Slack and other tools. The adversaries, right? The bad actors, they know two things to be true. People make mistakes, and they spend most of their time in email and Teams and Slack. So what do? They find ways to get in front of people and take advantage of the types of mistakes they know humans make. Articulating that in a way that makes our brand stand out is the challenge that we have. We're working on it all the time. We're continuing to refine. We're running campaigns. We launched a new campaign just a few months ago. And we're really focusing at core at this concept of risk and helping people rethink risk so that it becomes something that they can better associate with what Mimecast can help them combat. But it's not easy. And it's also part of the fun of it. A lot of work has been done in the company. We have a lot of legacy, but we're in a dynamic, competitive landscape. And we have to constantly figure out how do we address the hot thing at the moment or the current challenge or the current attack, the thing that is fighting for budget. And sometimes it's just a financial decision because there's finite budgets in IT organizations and they're trying to make them go further all the time.
One of the things I found really interesting in the B2B software world is that there seem to be certain aspects of the core foundational brand marketing process that everyone adopts. And one of them being like the ICP, right? The ideal customer
yep.
profile and segmentation. Like how important is that? And if everyone's doing that, then
if everyone's doing it, then no one's doing it. Yeah. We certainly have invested heavily in building an ICP, understanding what that looks like and how we can get to them. And it's, to put it bluntly, it's a necessary but not sufficient tool in the full arsenal of your tools. And asking that question really asks a different question, in my opinion, which is, does the contemporary marketer fully understand all the things that they need to be thinking about in order to be effective? That is, it's not simply, we're just going to buy a bunch of keywords and there we go. And it's not simply, I understand my ICP. I just have to walk up and down the street and ask them, do you fit this profile? Okay, here, bye. Right. And it's not, I had an amazing creative and I'm going to push it out there. And it's not, we have an awesome website and hey, we have great partnerships. And like all of those things together create the unique moment when someone says, oh yeah, I want to talk to you about your thing. And in B2B, we know this in particular, there's often, like we look at the data, like we'll have customers who buy, you know, six-figure software deals. They'll have started their journey with us 2 years prior visiting our website. And they will have had 25, 35 or more interactions with us across a couple of years sometimes. Now, is there any one person or thing that can say, oh, I've mastered that? No. That's because when they started, we were probably doing different marketing than when they finished. And yet we have to bring them along that journey. And that's the beauty of it, is like, are they in our ICP? Well, maybe they were then, maybe they are now. I don't know. Like, did that white paper work? The website's completely different today, but they keep coming back. Because when you put on the customer's hat, ultimately the customer doesn't care if it's Mimecast or one of our competitors, if it's this or if it's that. What they care about is, I have a problem. I'm going to try to figure out how to solve my problem. And if it takes 2 years because I see a problem on the horizon, maybe those CISOs are really good pattern recognizers like I am in marketing. They're like, okay, I'm going to have to get to here and I'm going to begin a journey. And my consideration set, we talk about consideration set all the time. My consideration set of vendors, it may be big, it may shrink, but it may get bigger again. It may shrink. Oh, wait, consolidation in the industry shrinks, new players in the industry, it grows. And that's going to happen across time. Marketers can't think about this as some static, a customer wakes up and like, okay, I think I'm going to buy email security today. Mimecast, competitor in, number two, okay, boom. That's not the world that they live in. That's not the world we live in. It is truly a dynamic, multifaceted system that any of us are trying to market into.
So when I elevate even to the brand with a big B, even more, one of the things that I've observed that I found fascinating is when I look at tech and B2B, that the role of what in other industries you might think of as the corporate brand team,
yep,
right, that's looking after brand and with a big B, that's dealing with, yeah, okay, the overall brand strategy, that's dealing with the brand expression, the verbal, as a team that's trying to disseminate it, not just through marketing, but through other parts of the organization. And associated to that then is what previously was, we would think of brand governance, but today mm-hmm. we talk about as brand enablement. I'm not amazed anymore because now I've seen it so often, even with the biggest players, the ones with 70,000 employees, it's amazing how they may only have one person in that role, and how when you compare where they are in the actual maturity cycle, how immature that brand stewardship, brand management, the respect that that has is low. Because what you hear often is like, oh, no, process and stewardship is a dirty word, yeah, right? Or it gets in the way of innovation. I just want to get your perspective on that. If that's kind of how it operates at Mimecast and companies you've been at, or if you see that changing in any way, or is that an opportunity?
It's a complex question. Here it is, right? Like, the best brands make it look easy. And things that look easy, people take for granted. And I realize that I'm dumbing it down tremendously when I say that, but that's kind of the reality of it. Like, I'm fortunate that I have an amazing brand and communications leader who works on my team, and we have a very strong creative team that works for her. We have great external agency partners that help us with this, and we care a lot about the brand. But it also, it varies from one company to the next, varies on the stage of the company, as you said. And you can look at big companies that do think very coherently and consistently about their brand. You can pick a Microsoft or an IBM in our space, right? They truly have invested in an amazing perspective and experience, and they are stewards of the brand ultimately. But there are a lot of companies that are not, and they don't know what their brand means. And they think, and they confuse brand with advertising, and they confuse brand with company culture, and they confuse brand with a bunch of other things. And brand is all of those things and none of those things. It truly is something unique that needs that cultivation. And it's my favorite part of what I do, and it's the hardest part of what I do. I literally know that almost anything I do related to brand is probably not going to be as successful as I want it to be. And it's often because there are so many other factors that I don't necessarily control. And I know, because I've been through this enough times, that I'm not just speaking to one audience when I think about brand. I'm not just speaking to customers. I'm speaking to customers, partners, competitors, employees, investors, if we're private or public company, both of them matter, right? Analysts in the industry, random people on the street who say, oh, I know that brand. And frankly, all of them matter at some level. And everyone wants their own brand experience. And I often joke about the fact that a company website is an amazing thing. But when we think about where we are in 2024 and the power that our websites give us, the most sophisticated, and we have an amazing, sophisticated, really high-performing website. But every visitor to that website, depending on who they are, has their own unique experience of it. And if I've built it to cater to one category, it might not deliver the experience another category wants. And I say that because it's one of the defining problems of the modern B2B marketer, is how to somehow navigate all these pieces simultaneously, particularly in really competitive spaces where you have five other companies that offer almost the exact same thing as you do.
One of the most memorable presentations that I saw was from the head of brand at American Express a few years ago, and she was talking about their brand maturation. And one of the things that she did is she did analysis of her calendar and where she was having meetings and how that had changed over 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And when she first got there, 80% of her meetings were internally within the marketing team. And 2 years down the line, 80% of her meetings were with functions that were outside of marketing. And that was a way in which she knew that brand was starting to get diffused and disseminated more across the organization. But that's the work, how hard it was in order to try and drive some of that.
That's a great example. It's also one of my favorite brands. I think they actually do an amazing job with an absolute, you know, standard of brands in their sector. But it's true, like everyone participates and everyone should. But at what level should they participate? Like everyone inside a company participates in finance. Like we all spend money, we all make money, we all make decisions and impact. But at what level should we be deeply engaged in understanding the general ledger or other specific aspects of finance? Everyone in the company interacts with marketing. At what level should people actually be engaged in the marketing part of it, the real sort of underlying parts of it? And that's a challenge a marketer's face every day.
And where does journey mapping or experience come into that? Because if you can explain it then based on what the function that you're in and how that touches the customer, is that something that is a conduit?
It's interesting because I think that's things like journey mapping and customer experience are critical to delivery and to creating the right environment and the right journey for the customer. I'm not sure that people see the connection always between that and like the, oh, and now I have to think about the company brand or what we're doing in marketing. I'm happy to say that I'm a brand marketer. It's one of many things I do, and I've done it repeatedly, and I believe in it, and I have great characteristics of it, but I don't know that most people actually know what that means, even if they're another brand marketer. It's because it ultimately does mean something different. And I even think, reflect on what I'm doing today at Mindcast after 14 months at the company. We're very excited about the work we're doing on the brand, but it is both the same and distinctly different from what I did at my previous company, what I did at a company before that, what I've done at others. Like the brand is this truly unique, amorphous almost organic thing that within each company, you have to learn enough about the culture, about the competitive situation, about the customers, about the environment, about the macros, to be able to do a good job being a steward of the brand.
And you can be in the same company and that completely change 180 overnight if there's a change in leadership, because you can have a CEO who sees the brand as a catalyst to his transformation, his or her transformation journey. And then overnight, all of a sudden, a new CEO comes in and says, no, we don't want all of this stuff. I don't want to listen to this stuff. I'm just focused on the spreadsheet.
That's right. And
that's what makes it
happens
interesting.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yes. And it happens all the time. And you're right in that. And our job as in marketing is to be sensitive to that and to not pursue a path that's going to end up hitting a brick wall.
Norman, we could go on for hours talking about this. Let's just wrap up with a couple of questions just to understand a little bit more about you. What's an example of some of the greatest advice that you've received in your career?
Yes, I've gotten lots of good advice. I've gotten some bad advice along the way too, but I definitely have gotten good advice. And I think it falls into just a couple of things that, however trite, remain true. Which first of all was told to me long ago that I have to make sure that I am focused on, and this was early in my career, I'm focused on gaining the respect of others, not necessarily having them like or dislike me, and learning to differentiate respect from affinity or like or dislike is actually critical to helping you navigate the fact that not everyone is going to like you. But if they respect you for the ideas, the value, the capabilities you bring, that's important. And I think that's true to everyone. I've also found, I have, after many years, codified my own sort of what's your philosophy into things that actually came from advice that I and guidance I got from others over the years. And I bring it down to fundamentally trust, transparency, and communication. I want to create and engender trust in me, with me, and with others, across my team, across teams. I want to be as transparent as I can, always in everything that we do. And we're in marketing. We have to master communication, and we have to be really good at it. And I think proactive, appropriate communication goes a long way, whether that's one-on-one or one-to-many, it doesn't matter. Like being able to communicate and articulate what actually matters is critical. And I always believe, and it's humorous, but it's advice that I passed on to others. And it's meant a little bit tongue in cheek, but it's actually something to think about, which is you're never truly successful unless you have an enemy somewhere along the way. Someone told me that once, and I pass it on to others, and you can interpret it many ways, but it means ultimately to me, you have to be willing to put yourself out there, and you have to be willing to push when it might make someone uncomfortable in order to get the best results.
Final question: in a leadership role can be lonely sometimes. Where do you go for connections, or What do you kind of listen to also stay current?
It can be lonely. I'm fortunate that I have a good network of people in similar roles or at similar levels that I've built relationships with over time, and I can use them as sounding boards. I also advise a couple of small companies. That helps me understand things, and their companies outside my direct domain. So it helped me understand some of the hot topics that are going on there. And frankly, I actually continue to be and a believer that I'm a voracious reader, and I read everything, and it comes back to pattern recognition. I'll like pick up an article somewhere, and particularly in my space, everyone talks about cybersecurity in one form or another. They just don't realize that they're talking about it sometimes. Like, we live in an age of anxiety. Why do we live in an age of anxiety? Because there are threats all around us reaching into our phones and our email inbox and on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. And so I try to look holistically at what's happening in society and think about what it means for me as a marketer and as a leader, and how I create the best environment for my teams, for my company, and for our customers.
Norman, thank you so much for being on today. The time has flown by. It's been a wonderful conversation.
No, it's my absolute pleasure. And thank you. It is really a joy to be able to talk about the challenges we face, because I think in our field, you know, as a senior marketer, there's great opportunity. And I can't wait to see what the next generation of marketers are going to do.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.